In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy, live from Icon 32. Icon stands for what?
Island Convention.
Island Convention, because we're on Long Island.
Strong Island.
Nice. Now introduce yourself.
I'm Patrick Kennedy. I'm the comic book track leader for Icon, and it was nice enough to have Rick as my guest.
Oh, your guest? You're my guest, but we also have a very special guest, because Pat is great, but he's not very special.
No.
Well, introduce your voice to the listeners.
Daniel Knopf, writer, producer, you know.
Thing.
Maker-upper of stuff.
Stuff, but tell them what stuff.
Blacklist, Spartacus, Blood and Sand, Supernatural, and the Blacklist, which is a show I'm on right now.
Yeah, well, you said Blasphemous Fish. You didn't say Carnival.
Oh, I didn't say Carnival.
Yeah, Carnival was the original.
Well, it must
have
been a long last night.
It's it was.
It's sort of like that. It's sort of like in Blazing Saddles when the guy says rape twice.
Yeah, that's
true.
Right. Yeah.
Rape twice. He says, I like rape. It's like, I like Blasphemous. I like
Blacklist. Well, on that starting, we start with that. Give the listener a little bit of how you. Carnival was first, right?
Yes.
It's your first break thing. And you told me, we were at dinner last night, and he told me everything, but I'd like you to tell them quickly how, because you started late.
Yeah.
In the biz. In a biz that
broke in late. I started at age 27, really seriously, taking writing seriously.
Right. Yeah. And during that time and up until your breakthrough, you were a?
I was a health insurance broker.
A health insurance broker.
Yeah. And so I was basically, my function was, and it was it was really a good job.
Yeah.
Because my job description was to severely and repeatedly kick insurance companies in the balls until they gave my clients the rates I wanted them to give them.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever that's your job description, that's kind of a white knight thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm coming in, I'm going to save you some money because these guys, Kurt Vonnegut used to say the big insurance buildings, the whole headquarters buildings, they're all mortared with blood and bone, and he's right.
Yeah.
You know, and so I did that for 22 years. I was actually pretty good at it.
Just curious, what led you to that?
It was a family business.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was like one of those opportunities. I got out of college. Actually, I was in college, and I was working a kind of a crappy job and in payroll at an engineering firm, and I was making like $600 or $800 a month. And my dad would say, you should finish college. You need to finish college. Meanwhile, I'm seeing that, you know, these boneheads that I'm working for, the only thing they got that I don't have is a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, maybe Dad's right, but I was married.
Oh, you
know?
My.
And it's like, I'm not a kid anymore. You know, I can't have Daddy pay for college. And then we both had this bright idea one day. And it was like we both called each other. I said, Dad, you want to have lunch? Yeah, I'd like to have lunch. There's something I want to talk to you about. And he said, you know, how about this? How about I pay you the slave wages, and you just come to work for me, and you can set your own hours to accommodate 2 days a week in college. And so I finished up my degree. I just went in and I went to Cal State LA. Mm-hmm. I took transcripts from four or five institutions. And I said, what am I closest to? And if she'd said ping pong, I would have, I'm a ping pong major. But she said English. And I went, okay, I'm an English major. You know. And I came to school, I was an artist. I used to do, you know, started as an art major doing illustrations and graphic design and that stuff. And then I took a creative writing class at Pasadena City College under a woman named Jereen Hewitt,
mm-hmm.
who's one of those great creative writing, you know, 1A types of teachers who loved everything everybody did, no matter how shitty it was. and it was really encouraging. And what I found was, you know, it's one thing to sit down and you do a painting or drawing or a sculpture. It's quite another to, you know, you're taking, like, basically you're putting symbols down on a piece of paper and you're handing it to a stranger, and that person is looking at those symbols, which form words, which then form you're painting inside somebody's skull, and everybody's interpretation of those words is slightly different, so that each one is experiencing a different piece of art inside their heads. Mm-hmm. And it was, and that, I mean, there is no bigger canvas than the inside of another human head, human being's head. Because, I mean, I look at each one of us as like a little universe walking around. Mm-hmm. And so I said, wow. And what happened was my creative writing classes started sort of crowding out my art classes. And I wasn't doing any basic, you know, general ed and stuff. I was just taking electives because I was exploring. It's the 70s.
No.
I was finding myself.
The 70s.
Yeah. I did that in the early 90s.
You know what's really fucked is you sit there and finally you go, I'm going to buckle down and get my degree. Now you got to take all the general ed.
Yeah.
So I've been married for like 4 years. I'm in college. I'm taking like human sexuality, you know? And it's like, I got a kid. Right. I'm just like.
So you get a C. You get at least a C.
Yeah, well, I would ask really, like, really, just I'd raise my hand in the back and the teacher would be sort of, oh, God. And I'd say, why is it that, like, different women taste different? Just to make everybody in the class squirm. Everybody in the class is, like, 18 or 19 years old, and I'm, like, 50.
That certainly paints quite an interesting portrait in their brains, doesn't it? That personal question. So then,
well, it really depends on their diet. It's really funny when they start to actually answer.
Yeah.
It depends on what they've been eating.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like,
and what have they been bathing in?
And you're just sitting back there with your arms crossed with a smirk on your face. Nah. Yeah, look what I'm making her talk about, guys.
So how old were you then? How old were you then? Was that 27?
I graduated when I was about 22 years old.
Okay.
And then I went, by then I had a book of business with my dad. And I had no real intention of getting into the health insurance business. But I mean, I said, maybe I can make a living as an advertising copywriter. So I put together a portfolio, got on an airplane, came out to New York, stayed with a friend who had a place down in Brooklyn for about 6 weeks, humping around, calling, getting the sting, and this city ate me and spit me out.
So
I went home with my tail so thoroughly tucked between my legs, it was just like devastating. Yeah. And I just said, well, I guess I'm in the insurance business because I'm making good money. And I did it for, I lasted for about 5 years before I was quietly going insane.
And
I ended up checking myself into a mental hospital for depression. And the second day I was in the hospital, I started writing, and I haven't stopped since.
There you go.
So that's my story.
That's a heck of a story. Now let's get into, because of course this is called Action Film Autopsy. Did you gravitate? Were you watching movies by then?
I was a big fan. I was, not a cineast. I was a movie fan.
Right.
And I cut my teeth on sneaking into Dirty Harry.
There we go.
And then you had this kind of in a big way, and I think the pre-digital world, where if a guy drove a car off of if guys, when there were human beings in the cars.
Yeah.
And they weren't basically just digital constructs, and people were actually putting their lives on the line. So there was that aspect, the danger aspect of, wow, they're really doing this stunt. When you saw it, it kind of takes your breath away. Now you watch it, and it's like watching, it's like watching a cartoon.
Video game.
A video game, exactly.
Yeah.
But back then, I was just, and I was a big fan of like stunts and stuntmen that whole aspect of it. And we had this sort of renaissance, I guess, there's a cool factor. We always had action movies were always big.
Yeah.
Going back to Bullet.
For me, it was Dr. No. James Bond was boom.
That well, the James Bond one is almost like a subgenre in itself.
Very much so, yeah.
And so James Bond, yeah, of course. And but then you had those really cool movies like The French Connection.
Oh, yeah.
And they were the gritty things that had the cinema de vérité. It was like, this is really happening. And you had that car chase, which is really almost pretty much unsurpassed. I'd say dead heat between the Bullet car chase and the French Connection car chase.
You see 7-Ups?
Never have seen that.
Oh, well, then, as a car you should get it. As a car chase person, that I rank that one up there.
Oh, really? I'll have to see it.
Predominantly for the acting of Roy Scheider.
Yeah. When you get an actor behind the wheel, one of the most effective car chase sequences in you know, even last 20 years was Ronan.
Yes.
And then you had De Niro behind the wheel, and he's driving against traffic, and he looks like a guy who's driving against traffic. It's like he's got this total focus, concentration. He's acting behind the wheel, and it's not like he's just one wheel in it, you know?
Yeah. Spoiler alert, although any listener of this podcast know that this is spoiler full, not spoiler free. I have a little song that goes to the tune of my personal motto song, which is I'm a dumb guy. I have a song called I'm a dumb guy, which I sing to myself constantly. But I adapted it for this.
Singing that to myself.
Yeah, I'm a dumb guy. I'm a dumb guy. But we adapted it for this podcast. Is there'll be spoilers. There'll be spoilers. So what I'm going to say, the reason
Keep
I mentioned
girl.
That. Yeah,
it's
that's right.
Too far.
Yeah. The Seven Ups. Roy Scheider's acting is astonishing. It ends with Roy Scheider's car. He's playing basically the same character he's playing in French Connection.
It's kind of the French Connection sequel, except
Gene Hackman's not in it, and it's all about the Roy Scheider character. He has another astonishing chase, actually filmed on location, nothing on set. The only
Who
thing
directed
on set,
it?
I think Philip D'Antonio
wasn't Friedkin. Yeah,
but it was. It's an awesome chase, but it ends with him crashing into the back of a parked or a stalled truck,
which takes us to Vanishing Point.
Yes,
really.
However. What happens?
Which is a cross-country chase where he ends up.
What makes it? Roy Scheider is one of my favorite reaction actors. His reactions in Jaws.
Yeah.
You know, we got to get a bigger boat, and that kind of stuff is astonishing.
Well, all
this
the
one,
really great actors are actually great reactors.
Yeah. But he has a moment where he has to see he's about to crash into the back of it, and they're on the set, filming his reactions, and they tell him, "Okay, this is the moment where." You have to do this. He says, give me a second. He walks off the set. He says, when I come back on set, start filming. Don't say anything to me.
Yeah.
Just start filming. And so he walks back on the set. They start filming. He gets behind the wheel. And you see it in the movie. You see his reaction, which is astonishing.
Yeah.
For a person who likes actors and knows acting.
He's owning that moment.
He's just incredible. Yeah. Even in the Jaws, when they have, in addition to the scene where he comes into the shot after seeing the shark for the first time, before he says, we got to get a bigger boat.
Yeah.
That's an amazing reaction.
That's an amazing, Redford's another one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The best reactor I've ever personally worked with was Amy Madigan.
Really?
Amy Madigan is phenomenal. And to any actors out there or aspiring actors, if you're a reactor, you will don't sit there and count your lines.
Right.
Okay, if you're a great reactor, you're going to get more screen time than anybody else because while everybody else is just sucking, we didn't have anybody that sucked on Carnival, but you know if a scene was sort of falling flat due to the writing or whatever we were, you know whatever was happening, it was like. We can go to Amy, and there's always going to be something interesting going on with Amy, and you're gonna hang on that actor. Entire scenes I remember would be just the other actors. You hear their voices, and we'd just be on Amy. So you know, you become that kind of an actor, and you are the editor's best friend. You're the showrunner's best friend. You're the writer's best friend. You're really the audience's best friend.
Yeah.
And so, I can't say enough about how important reacting is listening to the other person, what they're saying, and actually building that reality.
Projecting your thoughts onto the audience without a word.
Exactly. And that takes us to the ecstasy of recognition and all of that.
Well, let's jump to the chase because we have you here. Exactly. That's
no
why
pun
I said it.
It's action.
I like it.
Pun fully intended.
I know. Let's blow this whole thing.
That's right. Yeah, there you go. But, you know, I have you as a guest on. We can digress about our childhood. I mean, I usually try to do it in order, but let's jump. Let's cut to the chase.
I was
you become a writer.
Wolves.
Yeah, we know that story. All right, but Carnival was your first thing, right? Was the
it wasn't.
Go ahead, because you alluded to last night that you jumped into this.
It was
fresh.
My first TV.
Yeah,
it was really weird. I started writing, and I'd had a little bit of success, and it was like the seventh feature script I'd written. I was writing features.
Yeah. And he produced?
My brother calls me up and he says, hey, I got a client I want to refer to. He was a company rep. He worked for Principal Mutual.
Okay.
I said, yeah, I got a client I want to recommend to you. He needs a Blue Cross policy. And I said, I don't do individual work. You know that. I just work with you know, employee groups.
Yeah.
And he goes, this guy's a movie producer. And I said, oh, okay, let's do that. Yeah. So I meet with Neil Moritz, who ended up doing the Fast and Furious.
Right.
And he was at that time partnered with David Heyman, who did Harry Potter. Mm. So that was that team. It was a pretty amazing team.
Yeah.
I meet with Neil, and I'm selling him a health insurance policy. I say, I do a little bit of writing, you know, and he's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
And he says, what are you working on? I said, I'm doing a thing about a blind gunslinger.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And he goes, well, that's interesting. I kind of woke him up. He says, how far into it are you? I said, I think I'm about 40, 50 pages into the thing. I hadn't, at the time, I just had fallen by the wayside because I was busy with babies and things. So I go home and I look at him. I'm like page 17. And I'm going,
oh, well.
And he starts calling me. Is it done? Is it done? Is it done?
Jeez.
And I hammer it out, and we end up getting HBO buys it as a feature back in the days when they did movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we cast Armand Desante,
I saw that,
Robert Davi, and Elizabeth Shue in a thing called Blind Justice.
Justice. Mm-hmm.
Which I hated that they had the word blind in it. My original title was Kanan's Way.
Oh, nice.
And it was a spaghetti western.
Yep.
Basically, spaghetti western Zatoichi.
Yep.
And it was, and okay. So I made this, which is a real, I mean, it's, to be able, in this day and age, to say, I made a Western.
Yeah.
It's such a delightful thing to do because you walk in and there's the horses and the guys, they're practicing with the guns and the bullwhips and stuff. And it's a real world.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I walked on the set, and I was just like, wow. You know, this was all inside my head. Now it's outside. That strange sense of the schizophrenic who thinks he's been followed by men in black, who suddenly realizes he's really being followed by men in black.
Yeah.
It's like all this shit existed inside my skull and now I'm walking through it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a surrealistic thing the first time it happens. And I remember the thought creeping in my head, is like, this is great, but what if it's the last thing anybody ever does that I do?
Yeah.
And it kind of manifested.
Yeah.
I had meetings after that, and I was a journeyman. I'd get some development deals, and nothing was happening for years. And I was really at a point where I was going, okay, I hit 40.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to give, this is done, I'm done.
Yeah.
I told myself, when if I get to 40, I'm going to go to start writing novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a really sore loser. I come from a long line of sore losers going back to the Middle Ages, okay? I mean, my people were like they were mean Germans, you know? And one of my ancestors was guillotined trash talking Hitler. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
You have that on your t-shirt?
My people were just balls out asshole.
Oh my God.
So
I am changing the name of this podcast. His relative was guillotined for trash talking Hitler.
So that's something, you know, that's like, you know.
I'm buying you a drink.
Okay. Well, you buy him a drink.
Yeah.
Buy the part of him in.
Pour it down his neck.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he probably was trash talking him after they chopped off the head for about 7 seconds.
He's probably still doing it today.
He's just lipping.
Yeah, he's doing it today down in heck.
So I realized, you know what? I'm going to take a real run at this. I'd never really networked. I'd never really done the thing where I'm selling myself.
Yeah,
this is about 2000. And
selling insurance policies, not yourself.
No, never the writing. I was focused on developing my craft. That's all I was interested in. I wanted to just get better. And I said, okay, I'm going to take one last run at this. I took the scripts that I had, first acts of maybe a dozen scripts, mm-hmm. threw them up online in a thing called Unmovies, which kind of became a thing of its own because I was blogging before the word blog even existed,
yeah.
And I would call them rants, and I would just go on. And my whole thing was, I've made these mistakes. Don't make these mistakes. These are all the boneheaded mistakes you can make to throw your to never not have a career. So
mm-hmm.
don't be me. And it became, you know, I'd get letters and stuff, and so a lot of it was inspirational and so forth. And people would be sending me things, and then I get a call from a guy named Robert Kaobod, who says, I read your pilot, and I'm thinking, what pilot?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized this was a bottom of the bottom drawer script. I mean, this is the kind of thing where it's in the bottom drawer of a desk in your basement, and every once in a while you go down there and throw meat to it, you know? And it was Carnival, and I said, I was going, what pilot? And I realized, oh, yeah, I took this script that was completely unwieldy. It was like 220 pages, and I thought, yeah, maybe I can do a pilot. So I managed to excise a pilot out of it. And he said, I want to read the rest of it. So I sent it to him. And his boss was Scott Winant, who is one of the best television directors you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, multiple Emmys. And are we good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Keep going.
Oh, okay. Lights just went out, so I hear the sound.
Sorry, yeah, just to let you know at home.
Okay.
The lights went out.
The haunted class.
There you go.
Something happened.
Yeah.
Okay, so
here. So Scott Winant.
Pretty soon Ring Girl's going to walk through the back door.
Awesome.
So Scott Winant has me in this office, and we basically developed Carnival together.
Mm-hmm.
And I already had the pilot script, and he taught, you know, he told me about doing the Bible building and series building, and we went and pitched it to HBO with a guy named Howard Klein,
mm-hmm.
and pitched it to Chris Albrecht during his time there, was the time where they had The Sopranos and Sex and the City, and it was basically the golden age of HBO,
mm-hmm.
and God, they bought it.
Yeah.
So that was my first TV gig. I was a executive producer, creator of an HBO series, which mm-hmm. is kind of like, that's where everybody who works for 20 years is trying to get to.
Yeah.
And that was my first gig. And so it's been downhill ever since.
That's been done. Yeah. Well, you did HBO
as
Blind Justice, and you did HBO as Carnival.
Yes.
But you also mentioned the other stuff you've been doing. I mean, we can talk about Blacklist, which is the latest. What is your position? Are you a staff writer on
Blacklist? No, I'm an executive producer.
You're an executive producer.
So I'm an executive producer, staff writer. I work with a guy named John Eisendrath, who's the showrunner, who's brilliant.
Right.
And then John Bokenkamp, who's the show creator, who is brilliant. And John Bokenkamp created a sandbox that's like the coolest sandbox on Earth.
Yeah.
And it stars James Spader, who is a force of nature.
And speaking of cool sandboxes,
he is, and he's an executive producer on it, and he's very involved in every aspect of the show. He's not just an extra paycheck for James.
Mm-hmm.
He makes a major contribution to the show, and literally we'll go through every single script page by page with each one of the writers, you know,
mm-hmm.
every time out the door, and not just his role.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about everything that's in that script. And you know, speaking, like I was just saying before the show, you know, because this is all about action, is, you know, shows like this, procedurals, action shows, that kind of stuff on TV, they generally don't get awards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's for, you know,
serious drama, serious comedy, whatever. Yeah, highfalutin.
But we have consistently, I think we've got 2 years in a row, we scored awards for a stunt coordinator. Now, being a stunt coordinator on an hour network drama is probably the hardest job in the world, because, you know, in a movie, as you know,
mm-hmm.
you have days to shoot a car chase. We're lucky if we have, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours, and just getting all the coverage you need and doing it safely is just an immense challenge. And we don't have the money to do the digital work, so it's all real stunts.
Mm-hmm.
And we get some pretty, you know, it's not like, you know, big budget action movie. It can't be. It just simply cannot. You can't deliver that level of you can't deliver that level of production value in a TV show. But we take our bites, and we have some pretty hairy stunts on the show, and especially the vehicular stuff, which is always shocking to me, because the first show I was on, I remember writing this thing, and I was with Alex Gonza, I think he's show running The Americans,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's not The Americans, it's
we can look it up on IMDb.
Anyway, Alex did, he came out of the X-Files land, and Alex, I remember telling Alex, I had this great scene where a police car drives off of a mountain road,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it doesn't blow up. It just goes down the
Thank
hill
heaven,
and crashes.
Yeah.
And I said, can I do this? He said, just write it. Just write it. Just write it. And I'm going, I don't want to write it if it's...
You can't do it.
And naturally, I did it, and, you know, we couldn't do it. So,
oh.
You know, it's like, well, you know, really, Alex, don't make
So me. Were you on Blacklist from the beginning? Or did you
No,
on?
I'm... John and I worked on a show called My Own Worst Enemy that was very brief. Was
oh, I remember that.
With Christian Slater.
Right.
And he and I hit it off, and I was doing Dracula. NBC,
right? John Reese
Myers. The year that Blacklist
premiered.
And so John had wanted to work with me again, and as soon as Dracula was canceled, John threw a party and hired me. But so I came on board in the second year, and I've been there ever since.
Awesome.
And it's been a phenomenal experience. I remember my agent calling me, and she says, "Would you consider not running a show?" And I said, "Okay, if it's a hit." if it's been on for it's a second year or longer, and if I'm working for somebody who is going to teach me something.
Awesome.
And not only have I learned a lot, even with the other writers, Luke Ryder and just a number of, Dave Thomas was on the show for a while, Dan Tirone, I mean, really good top flight guys. And it's week to week, we're pounding 20 pounds of coffee into a 5-pound can.
Oh, baby.
And I've learned just from the craft standpoint an immense amount. But just, from the standpoint of day-to-day show running and that kind of thing, John does a great job, and I've learned from that. So it's been a great experience.
Well, I'm curious about the greatest hits in between Carnival and Blacklist.
Oh, between Carnival
and the worst hits.
There's some that
worst kicks, the greatest hits.
The first gig I had after that, I did an episode of Supernatural called The Striga.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a witch.
Mm-hmm.
They were sitting there and they're saying, "We want to do something about a witch, but witches aren't scary, And I go, "Oh no, I can make a scary witch, dude." And so I made this story, and it started with like this couple putting a baby to bed. And then you see, like, it's like a tree, and there's wind outside, and the twigs are going against the sheer curtains. You can see the shadows of the twigs, and then you realize, oh, shit, these aren't twigs. These are fingers.
Ooh.
They're long. They look like twigs. And this thing comes in. It's shrouded, and it goes to the baby's, and it's leaning over the baby, and it's reaching for the baby, and then we crash cut to the next day outside the house, and there's this high-pitched scream of the mother just in the, and you go into the thing, and we just do slow move and look down into the crib, and there's like a pile of sticks and rocks and bird's bones in there, and it's like, whoa. And so I pitched this thing to Ziski, to Eric Kripke, who's the show creator and runner, and I finished this thing, tell the whole story, and he goes, "So?" And I go, "So what?" And he goes, "Well, what happened to the baby?" I said, "The baby? Oh, that baby's fucking dead." And he goes, "Okay, Dan, I know you've been on HBO for a while, but the difference between HBO and network television is if a baby disappears at the beginning of the episode, it's got to turn up by the end of the episode."
Yeah.
So it's like, that's the difference between, pay cable and, network television.
As a teenager on Riverdale, she has to show up. So you did Supernatural. Anything else that comes to mind immediately? Because now I'm fascinated.
I did a show called Standoff that was on for about 10 seconds.
Right.
And not really my cup of tea. It was more of a procedural thing.
Ooh.
Got a call from my agent sent me in to meet Steve tonight. Oh, by the way, while I was doing Carnival, I had Carnival was sort of hadn't been greenlit to pilot yet, and while we were developing at HBO, my agent sends me out on to a thing, and he says, "It's a show. It's on TBS." And I'm going, "Oh, okay. I've never done this. I've never been in a room. I've never been. I'd never been a TV writer."
Oh, that's fun, isn't it?
And so, over at HBO, I'm just working on the pilot, which is like being a screenwriter, a screenwriter who actually, has some power. So I went over and I met with Alex Gonza. And he said, he had me watch the pilot, nobody's seen the pilot, don't talk about the pilot, NDA. And I watched the pilot. He said, "So what do you think?" I said, "That's awful. It's like the most awful thing I've ever seen. It's one long first act. It makes no sense at all." And he says, "Well, what would you do?" And I said, "Well, I'd do this, and this." And it's a community of werewolves. They'd have their own religion. They'd have their own culture. They'd have, they're isolated. It'd be like any other isolated population. And I just start riffing. And he hired me in the room.
No.
And I go, "Oh, well, okay, I guess I'm on a network show." And I call my agent up and I said, "Hey, I think I got hired here." And he goes, "Really?" And I said, "Wow, I'm doing a TBS show." And he goes, "No, it's CBS."
Oh.
And I'm going, I call my ex, I call my wife, and I said, "Hey, it's not TBS, it's CBS.
And what was the show?
It was called Wolf Lake.
Wolf Lake.
It was on
for
six episodes.
Yep.
And so then Carnival got greenlit, and I went on to Carnival.
Right.
Then there was there was other shows. The Spartacus Blood and Sand was with Steve Tonight,
right?
Which was a lot of fun. The Sword and Sandals.
What did you
big
do?
Action.
Writing on that show or producing? Or?
Usually, when you're on staff, generally you'll have a title as a producer,
right?
You know, so I was consulting producer on that. I came in around episode 5 and worked on episode 5 on, and more or less ran the room while Steve did his job.
Wow.
And that's kind of the, you know, so I was functioning as a co-exec.
Obviously. That's an action show.
It was a big action show. We shot it in New Zealand on a nickel. the actors were living in tents, you know.
Really?
In the middle of nowhere. And we had a lot of green screen work, a lot of digital blood and gore.
Hold on for a second. The microphone is drooping rather suggestively.
Yeah, I know.
And
I have that effect on my
microphone. Yeah, it was doing it on my mic before, but now you came into the room.
That's
good.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, all right.
No, this room's haunted. Anyway.
I think you're right. The lights went out.
So I did that for a little while, and again, every show you're on, you're a sponge, and you learn.
Sponge. You learn.
I hope.
A lot of people don't.
We were shooting that in New Zealand.
Were you living in New Zealand at the time?
No. Everybody was in L.A.
Okay.
The Dracula we shot in Budapest.
Yeah.
I was in L.A. Blacklist we shoot in New York City.
And you're in L.A.
And I'm in L.A. Yeah. And I was spoiled on Carnival. I was, you know, literally we're shooting in Santa Clarita. I was literally upstairs from the stage. I could come down to any time if there was a problem. And what I've learned is that if you've got the writers, especially the high-level writers, separated from the production, it's gonna result in a loss in quality.
You can't,
it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
Things don't travel well. They don't get communicated. And especially when it was New Zealand, which was their day is our night, and it was just impossible communication. When Budapest, I would get back my dailies, and it would just be like. And it's a former communist country, so there's no freaking work ethic. I'd get back my dailies. They'd be gorgeous because the people producing it were the Downton Abbey people.
Yeah.
So it'd be absolutely stunning, but they'd be like, that's it? That's like, there's three setups here. That's a day? You know, and I'm just picturing these guys sitting around eating borscht, you know. Like,
what else is there to do?
Oh, my God.
Budapest, you know? That's not fair. Budapest,
that's one of my pet peeves is now they'll go, oh, Budapest, big production center. Yeah. And you go, there's only two, as far as I'm concerned, you got crews in New York and you got crews in L.A., and they're like the Dodgers and the Yankees, and these guys, they're crackerjacks.
Yeah.
So 5 days of shooting in New York is going to net you more usable coverage than 10 days or even 15 days in Budapest.
Yeah.
The only other place, you know, then you get into like Vancouver, they've got some great crews up there.
Okay.
And Georgia now has become really big, but... it's very, when you get into some of these things where we get these tax breaks and we can get twice as many days for the same money, and it's like...
You'll need twice as many days.
Yeah. I mean, when I buy a car, I don't look at what year it is. I look at how much mileage is on it.
Yeah.
And really what it is, how much coverage am I going to get?
Yeah.
Don't tell me about days. I want to know coverage, you know?
And if you're sending a car to New Zealand, you better have a mechanic there in New Zealand to work the car.
Well, change where the drone.
Yeah.
We didn't have any cars in Spartacus, though.
No.
There were no car chases.
Well, chariots.
No, we didn't even have, I don't think we had a chariot. I can't remember any chariots. All we did was cut people up.
Yeah, among us. Well, in one way or the other.
My favorite action, you know, I remember talking to Steve Tonight, and Body Otis was the big bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And wonderful actor. British guy, and I just can't remember his name. It's terrible, but everybody would know him. He's done a lot of fanboys.
We have a thing at the Action Film Autopsy.
Somebody look at it.
Called the supplemental. I always write a supplemental that goes with the podcast, so I will find out his name. It'll be in the supplemental.
This guy's really good. I'm not going to waste time on my cell phone. I'm looking over at you, and I'm going, come on, doesn't somebody have
you've already said
rescue me.
You already said several things that I'm going to have to look up and put in the supplemental for this.
So
to the supplemental, people.
Supplemental, folks. Go to the supplemental.
By the way, it's not supplemental. It's supplemental. Mental,
and I end up using that guy. I had him in Carnival. He played he came in and played a two-part episode.
We'll find it.
Wonderful actor, and he's Body Otis. And I said, okay, Steve, have you figured out how Body Otis is going to buy it? know, because we know that Spartacus is going to kill Batiatus, because Batiatus runs the Ludus, and he's...
Ian McNeice.
Is that it? Are you sure? Show me his picture.
Oh, wait.
I don't think that's it.
He was...
Look up Batiatus.
Yeah, that's...
No, that's not
that's him.
That's not him.
Don't worry. Let's not wait. We'll find it. It'll be in the supplemental.
Oh, you know
it'll
what?
Be in the supplemental.
Sorry, that was the Spartacus remake from 2004.
Oh, okay. In any case.
I dropped the ball
so
on
we
that.
So we got Batiatus.
Really?
So we got Batiatus, and I said, how's he going to die?
Yeah.
And he says, oh, yeah, he's just going to grab him, and he's going to stab him with his sword, and then he's going to slash his throat. And I said, oh, boring.
Because
my job on Spartacus was to come up with the most grotesque ways to kill. I was like, okay, he's a big, giant guy, and the two guys grab their chain, they wrap it around his neck, and they pop his head like a zit. Just,
did he freeze him, by the way?
No.
No. Guys, give it up. I will find it. Give it up. We've got a podcast
show
going on
here. Anyway, so I said, you can't kill Batiatus. It's a whole season of hating this guy.
That's not him.
That's not him.
He's a big deal. You'll know.
By the way, everybody who's speaking, I have to have your permission to be on the podcast. Are you okay? For, don't say thumbs up. Say
I'll give
you permission.
Chart so you can credit me.
Yeah, I have your permission.
You have my permission.
And Patrick, I have your permission.
Yeah, well, certainly.
And everybody in the room, I have your permission.
Any laughter, we need your permission in order to allow
that's
your laughter
right.
to appear on the podcast.
That's
and
right.
And so, Batiatus, I said, you're just going to slash his throat?
I have a suggestion.
And he says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, what I'd do is I'd have him grab him in an embrace and take his sword and just jam it right into his guts. And then he just starts sawing through his ribs. And he just totally inviscerates him. It's like his entire contents of his stomach just fall out on the ground. He falls to his knees and his steaming intestines all over the ground. And then I'd have Spartacus go behind him and grab a loop of his intestines, wrap him around his neck and strangle him with his own entrails.
Yeah.
I said, that's so cool. I'm all excited about my pitch.
Yeah.
And Steve's just looking at me. And he goes, Dan, I'm not going to have Spartacus kill Batiatus by strangling him with his guts. That's a no-go.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, well.
So
oh,
what
well.
Happened to him?
Or not.
Or not. My suggestion is you put Batiatus in a crib outside the window. There's this tree that turns out to be fingers. Anyway,
what come back at the end of the
what did happen to Batiatus?
He got killed.
In a boring way?
No, I mean, it's always good.
Okay.
Well, look it up. It was a very well acted.
I'm going to go to YouTube and see if I can find Death of Batiatus.
The actor was John Hannah.
That's it.
John Hannah.
Woo! You win the contest.
The amateur.
Can we use your voice?
Yeah. You already gave me permission.
Oh, yeah, okay. We'll get you a bagel.
So did that for about half a year, and then went on and other things, I guess, and Dracula, and then the Blacklist. I've been on the Blacklist for the last 3 years.
I'm getting a thread here. Oh, the Blacklist is awesome. James Spader is awesome.
Uh-huh.
You're awesome.
I've done a lot of different.
Are you doing any of the spinoff? The spinoff of the Blacklist spinoff?
I've lent an assist from time to time, I would say no.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some of the other writers have had a lot more to do with that,
right.
Especially like John Bokenkamp and Eisendrath has really been. You know, I think he's been doing a ginormous amount of writing on the show, but. You know, you're doing network, you're doing 22 episodes a season.
I know.
And it is an absolute grind. And now we've got, you know, another, I don't know how many, 9 episodes. It's a mid-season thing.
Okay.
So it's just an immense amount.
I've always thought, I was going to ask you about that because it's the equivalent of basically 7 movies a season, not even a full year. Seven movies in 9 months.
Oh yeah, yeah, and for peanuts, when you think
about
we've got take a pattern budget on of each episode, which I won't get into, but we're doing this for about 1/10 of a not well maybe 1/5 of a medium action movie budget. And I think that quality-wise, we're delivering about 80% of the quality. So, it's the law of diminishing returns. It's that shot of the scorpion crawling up the fence post that you spent waste all day on and kills you on features.
Well, I think John Wick was $30 million.
Uh-huh.
And so what
that must have been below the line. Keanu must have been
$30 million. No, Keanu is part of he's part of the action, literally, in that case. But, you know, what kind of, compared to like $30 million, are you doing more or less?
You mean per episode?
Or no, per episode.
Per season. 40 minutes.
Well, what's your episode? What's your general episode budget on?
Well, I can't something? Really
okay,
get
never mind.
I'd be uncomfortable getting
into that. I'm more comfortable to get into something that I'm noticing.
But I can tell you it's less than half of $30 million for an equivalent amount of hours or minutes.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's one movie. You're doing seven movies.
It would be like three episodes would be 126 minutes.
Jeez. Well, one of the themes I'm beginning to pick up here is you do like screen violence.
It's one of the things I was first really, because I had a background in visual arts.
Right.
And I was always really good at, of choreographing, things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And doing it in a way. I studied poetry, which I found much more helpful in screenwriting than anything else.
Wow.
In that every single word counts, and so you're very, because I read scripts every day where there's I call it back of the aspirin bottle prose, and it's like he walks into a room. The room is painted brown. There is a green carpet. There is a credenza behind a desk. They are made out of mahogany. There is a light on the desk. It has a green shade. And you're sitting here going, there's this guy on set. He's a production designer. Yeah. He's forgotten more than you're ever going to know about designing a set. And so what he walks into a room. It's the kind of room that would give a college professor a hard-on.
Yeah, there you go.
And there you go.
That's right.
No, you're done. And then the production designer comes in, who I've hired, and he's brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's like, when he delivers his sketches and he does this, it's like opening Christmas presents.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, you know. And if it isn't wow, it's you're fired.
Yeah.
But it's like I like to give everybody, the heads of all my departments, an immense amount of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they're happy.
Yep.
That's when people are happy, is when they're able to create and they're given that latitude. They don't want to be micromanaged. I'm not process driven. I'm results driven. Mm-hmm. It's just, and that's the way I write.
Well, what was the phrase you used last night? We were comparing Dashiell Hammett to Raymond Chandler.
Oh yeah,
the pick of the.
I wrote one zombie movie that never got made, and they open up with an M60 on this swarm of oncoming zombies, and it says they went down like a meat picket fence.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one.
I got meat picket fence.
You can almost see that.
Because people forget. In Dirty Harry was the thing that kind of like set you going from inspiration standpoint.
Yeah.
And people forget how violent that movie was.
Oh, Dirty Harry's crazy violent.
Yeah.
And what's really weird is, you started to see, something you didn't see in the 50s or even the early 60s is when there'd be a gunfight and there'd be the lady with the shopping bags who'd take a hit and fall down, where innocent people were being squibbed and hit, and it's shocking.
Yeah.
You don't even see that really in James Bond movies.
It's, no, James Bond has become family.
Yeah.
Family-oriented movie.
But you don't see just innocent people getting mowed down.
Right.
And that's what, that was the rough and tumble of sort of late 60s, early 70s action movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got into 48 Hours, which was sort of the beginning of this whole stylized thing, where it was these stylish action movies. And what's interesting about 48 Hours is you watch it and go, God, this thing has so many cliches in it. It's so cliche. But it's kind of like reading a portrait of Dorian Gray, in that, Oscar, it would be like Oscar Wilde would have. Was it Oscar Wilde?
Portrait during
And you'd read these things, and it would be these things that are now cliches, but he was coining them in the book.
Right.
And Walter Hill was coining the trope of steam rising from a grate, and rain slick streets, and lights reflected, and bad guys walking out of fog. All those things just didn't exist before 48 Hours, and then they became this thing.
What happens, though, is they get used so much that when Walter Hill does, I forgot, the Hitman movie with Bruce Willis, they become satire.
I love that
themselves.
Movie. You're talking about the one in the
Last
takes
Man
place?
Standing?
Last Man Standing?
Last Man Standing. Well, I
love
I,
that movie.
My favorite thing is when he's about to have the big gunfight, and all the other mobsters are standing behind him in the line of fire.
Yeah.
And it's like, these are the dumbest mobsters ever.
But it's
get out of the line of fire.
It's kind of beautiful on camera, but it's all very stylized.
Very mannered. Very mannered.
It's very staged.
Yes.
You know.
Do you have a very purposeful, I call that purposeful pacing, mm-hmm. where people are doing things that humans don't do?
Well, I think like Game Changers. 48 Hour was a game changer. 48 Hours was a game changer. Kind of went to Beverly Hills Cop and
yeah.
all that.
What was great about
48... Action buddy movie shit.
But more than that, it's basically that... it's sort of like Ghostbusters in a way, in that Eddie Murphy was a character from another planet who came into a cliched movie and turned the movie on its head.
Yeah.
It's another Aikido kind of film.
Yeah.
Where he's playing a character who reacts realistically to
stereotypes. And I think the next game changer was Die Hard. That was like the next game changer.
We were talking about
and
that
then
the other
the
day.
Next game changer after that was the Matrix, and so everyone had a big effect on all the whole genre after that.
But then what would happen with Die Hard? We were talking about that the other day. Up until at the era of Die Hard, we had Stallone and Schwarzenegger movies where they were killing.
Meathead movies.
They were meathead movies, but they were killing, what good meathead movies, they were killing massive amounts of people in ways they didn't care about, and also they were doing it with ease. They didn't care about they were killing hundreds or dozens of people. When we got to Die Hard, we have a character with passion and compassion, who showed effort and emotion.
I've got a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah,
one of the best things ever.
And and he showed pain.
I love those. Those are my favorite things. They do that in James Bond a lot. It's like whereas somebody totally underestimates the protagonist, mm-hmm. the audience here going, you know, they'll come up and say, "You're nothing, Mr. Bond. Bit on your shoes, you fool."
Yeah.
And you're going, "Oh, dude, you're talking to James Bond."
It's Bond, yeah.
They did that in Dirty Harry a few times. Yeah. It's that moment where you're going, "Oh, man, they are so screwing around with the wrong guy. He's going to take them apart."
And I knew that Connery was a great actor because Connery maintained his, what's the word, insouciance, his attitude, except when you pissed him off. And there was a moment where it dropped. And Connery showed the moment where it dropped.
Yeah.
When they killed the girl in
Goldfinger.
Where
he became a robot. He became the robot.
He became mad.
It was scary.
Became angry. And
angry robot.
Yeah. But Bruce Willis in Die Hard showed pain, showed effort. He worked
at it. The best guy selling pain to me is Mel Gibson. Nobody sells pain like Mel Gibson.
Because he loves pain.
I know, but, you know, when he's in, he's like, you're going, "Oh, wow, that must really hurt," you know, and he's so good at selling.
He's the greatest sadomasochistic filmmaker and actor ever.
Yeah.
If you cannot find a movie where he's not beaten, even in some of his, like, What Women Want.
Yeah.
He's still being tortured at some point. That man loves pain and he knows how to communicate.
Well, he plays.
But the problem is that in the case of all the game changers you mentioned, the game changer itself changes the game back because in Die Hard 3, he and Samuel Jackson, Willis, are dropping 60 feet onto a metal ceiling with no problem.
Yeah, I know.
Matrix 2 and 3.
I get to a point. Well, Matrix, because it's taking place in a digital environment
right.
or something, so that's allowable. You can violate things.
Yeah, well, that's not the problem with Matrix 2 and 3. The problem with Matrix...
Matrix 2 and 3, the problem is they blow.
They're stupid. Yeah, they're stupid.
They blow, like, wall-to-wall, stem-to-stern.
Yeah,
side.
Matrix 1 was smart, and those guys were stupid.
But you know what? My feeling is, like, what I go is... Matrix plus brains equals Dark City. Like, Dark City is such an amazing
movie. That's an awesome movie.
Yeah.
And
Kiefer is just so creepy.
And that's Alex Proyas. Right?
I think David Goyer wrote it, though.
David Goyer wrote it. Well, poor David. Oh. I mean, geez, again, you know, David, you can chart David's life. Is he working with a good producer or a stupid producer by the movie that results?
Well, David's just an amazing talent.
Yeah.
And I say that because I heard he's a fan of mine.
Oh, that's awesome.
So not only is he an amazing talent, but he has great insight.
Yeah, that's right. He knows good people.
So, yeah, but I met him once, and I met on... the terribly ill-fated Constantine.
Oh my gosh!
I finally got to meet David, so you know, he's amazing.
Well, let's talk specifically about the action. You like action. You like violence. You write good action. Is there an? Are you the way you're ahead on other things, like say your set designer or and decorator, when you're dealing with the action crew, when you write it, are you writing it in such a way that you know they can pull it off?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I pretty much know that this is doable. Almost anything's doable now with the digital stuff.
Yeah.
But doable on a budget for TV. I actually own and shoot guns. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And I do that because, and I'm completely intimately aware of the lethality of that thing. The idea, basically, you're taking a blasting cap, maybe like about an M half, like a M50, you know, a cherry bomb, and you're putting, you're locking it in a metal chamber, and you're, it's about 3 inches away from your face, and it's going to send a projectile out through a tube, and it's a violent endeavor, just shooting at targets, and the idea of taking this weapon and pointing it at anything that's made out of bone and blood and flesh is sort of terrifying. So I kind of like that'll play into, like, the gunplay. What I do is I don't have endless rounds. I don't have people racking a gun after they step into danger. I do a lot of things that, you know, and so I, the reality of that gun, and then the reality of being shot at, and I have been shot at. Ooh. And it's like, it's really, it's not, like, not it's pleasant. It's a sphincter tightening, kind of like, so you hear like that sound, that sort of beezing, you know, that it's like a bee, you know, and it's like, wow, I don't want to get hit by one of those.
Yeah.
And and that's never, you know, usually people just are very offhand. They're just shooting and the person
takes no effort.
Like 2 inches from a guy's face. You know, it's like a piece of mortar. It takes a hit, and they're just totally like, no big deal. But I mean, if like a bullet hit a piece of mortar at 2 inches from your face, you might piss yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you might actually you might actually drop a load.
I remember the first time I ever shot a handgun, and I've only shot a handgun a couple of times. But it was the first time I shot a .357 Magnum.
Of course you have. You're from New York. You put.
I was actually out in Minnesota. Yeah, they'll
arrest you if you don't have a gun.
But I had forgotten. I had been firing a .22 before that to get used to it.
That's like a cap gun.
Yeah. And then I had my
ear protection
off. Oh. My left ear,
oh.
And yeah, no. My ear was ringing for 3 days.
Of course. Afterwards. Well, I think one of the reasons that the John Woo, Chow Yun-Fat gun-fu movies, as we call them, were so successful is that Chow Yun-Fat is an amazing actor.
Mm-hmm.
And every time he pulled the trigger, you could see both the rush of power and the rush of fear on his face.
Yeah.
And that was the same thing in the original Die Hard, when he was still showing effort and emotion. And also he was aware. I liked when they were talking about the Oscar-winning Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah, and every single thing was a devastating
deal. Yeah, and one critic, I think, very accurately put it, is you knew where every bullet went.
Absolutely. You know, and you could read it on Clint's face.
Right.
It's a superbly acted film.
We all got it coming, kid. My favorite line in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess he had it coming.
It's not
we all
fair.
Got it coming.
It's not fair.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I was building a house. Just pretty amazing.
And it's such a violent treatise against violence.
Yeah.
So brilliant.
Could you still go watch TV or go to movies for pleasure anymore?
Oh, I've got really high standards.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a fun person to go to a movie with. That sucks.
Do you do it during the film, in the theater?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it's like when it happens, when you see something.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain things that you see where they go, they do something, and it's kind of like when it does work,
mm-hmm.
nobody's happier. I'm so thrilled to see something where there's a point you get when you fly past 50,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, it used to be you'd go to a movie and you'd go, I want my $8 back, man. That movie sucked. I want my $8
You're
back.
You're dating yourself
now,
for that price. Yeah,
yeah, I know. Yeah, well, that's when I used to think that.
Yeah.
Now I come out and I'm going, I want my 2 hours
back. Yeah.
Here's my 2 hours. worse. I'm going to be on my deathbed, and I'm going to be lying there, and I'm going to be thinking about this piece of shit movie. I'd really like to be able to tell my daughter how much I love her, but instead I wasted 2 hours on your piece of shit movie, you know?
But you can learn stuff from pieces of shit.
No, I mean, look, here's the thing about me. It's like,
I love pieces of shit.
Art, life is a process, and I've got a superpower, and one of my superpowers, and I think people get it as we get older, is the fine art of not giving a fuck.
Yeah, right.
You know, learning what to give a fuck about. Yeah. One of the things I really do give an F about is I tell my writers when I'm on a show, you don't work for the network president. You don't work for the studio president. You don't even work for me, okay? We all work for this person who comes home after a long day, and they've got a job that isn't nearly as interesting as our job. Mm-hmm. And all they have to show at the end of the day is they're 8 hours closer to the date of their own demise. That's all they've got. And they come home, and they throw a Lean Cuisine in the microwave,
oh
and they
God,
sit
God, I'm
down.
Gonna commit suicide.
They sit down, and it's like, just please move me.
Yeah.
Make sense. At least distract me for just a little while. Yeah. Just be entertaining. And if I say, if we are not always gonna be great. We may have a turkey or two come out, but it's not for lack of trying.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not giving 100% to make it as good as it can be, and we bore that guy, okay. We're in the mass media business, so like on The Blacklist, you know, we got 5 million viewers. So what we've done is we've just smoked 5 million hours of human life.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, think on that if you want to deal with the karmic blowback from that. You know, that's like
And if you're making a car, you've just killed a family.
Sort of.
It's a bad SUV.
So I take it really, really. I take my job very seriously, but that's because I spent so much time as a consumer of these products, and. You know,
want to be entertained.
I was a consumer much longer than I've been a manufacturer.
Right.
So
what's the movie or the television show? Do you watch any other television shows?
I don't. I mean, I'll watch. Right now, I'm kind of doing this just for research purposes. I'm doing. I've been binge watching The Twilight Zone all the way through.
Oh, the original. Oh, that's right. We were talking about our love.
Like
Sterling.
New stuff. I mean, when I talk about there's one movie . This is older. The newest movie I've seen that is really one of my favorite horror films is the Autopsy of Jane Doe, which was astonishing.
Yeah.
I saw that at a screening with Brian Cox and Emile Hirsch and Andre Overdahl.
So it was superbly acted. It's a good movie that happens to be a genre movie.
Right.
I mean, a really good movie and has so much heart. But there was another movie I saw, and I tell people, if you're going to watch this, you have to do this. You cannot watch it in pieces. You can't stop the movie and then go do something and then get back to it. Mm-hmm. You have to watch it all in one piece. And the people who don't do that will say, that's a terrible movie. I hated it.
No.
The people who do that say, oh, my God. And it was a movie called...
Let
me forget. It's called Martyrs. It's a French film.
Yes. Oh, Martyrs. Oh, geez.
And the thing he does is he's sort of like watching an amazing gymnast who comes off of the parallel bars, and you go, oh, she's going for a double. Oh, she's going for quadruple. How the fuck is she going to spike the mat? She's only like a foot above it, and he does it.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like the novel. The movie doesn't do it justice, but the novel Shutter Island, where you're getting to the end of the book and you've only got like 19 pages left, and you're going, there's no way he can do a satisfying ending.
Yeah.
It's just because this is going to be a car wreck.
Yeah.
And then you get to it and you go, oh, wow. And that's, to me as a writer, it's such a phenomenal piece of gymnastics that I just can't help but be wowed by.
So you're more likely to go to a horror movie than any other kind of film?
I know. I watch a lot of different kinds of films, and I'm doing a lot of streaming. But I cut my teeth on horror, and so I do like horror. And there's some interesting stuff being done these days.
They're getting out of their rut.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of jump scares. I'm not a big fan of gross outs. It's like seen it, done it. I love the whole. Dawn of the Dead. The whole Romero over here, because there's so much humor attached to it.
Right.
But for the most part, I'm not a big fan of things like, Walking Dead and stuff like
that.
Although I loved that Train to Busan was a
Train to Busan, both
wonderful
in the anime and in the live action version.
I didn't even know there was an anime version.
Yeah, it's really an awesome version.
Oh, okay.
Also, I love The Conjuring 1 and 2.
Oh, those are good.
Yeah, because good I don't like the kind of movies where you torture an innocent person for several hours and then
the
end
kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's, well, the original Saw was awesome.
I'm not a huge fan of nihilism.
The original Saw was great because it was a murder mystery.
Yeah,
and it was a Playfair murder mystery. But then the subsequent ones were just how many? Again, we torture you, torture you, you torture you, and then the movie ends.
Yeah, it was sort of like those Jason movies too. You know, the first one was kind
those
of fun,
become campy.
But after a while, it's just how many ways can you kill a person? Godzilla.
But then, Final Destination comes around, and then we have some pretty smart guys who know and have fun with it, and let you in.
Well,
on
I look
fun.
At, I look at, yeah, but there's that whole sort of J.J. Abrams self-referential, you know,
that's true.
Pop trope thing.
I can
kind
take
of
that in small
cold. Yeah. And I really, really hated the 90s for horror. It was just a wasteland.
Too.
As soon as Scream came out, it just sucked the guts right out of it. Right out of the hole. It just was such
I love
crap.
Scream.
I so hated that whole period. It was just,
afterwards, I understand, but Scream itself, I'm a big fan of.
Oh, I saw it. I was going, oh, no. Oh, this is going to be the next 10 years.
Oh, you poor thing. You were seeing ahead. I wasn't. Because I stayed away from horror at that point. I've written horror novels. I started with The Twilight Zone, worked on The Twilight Zone, met with Serling, loved The Outer Limits and all that stuff. But those weren't, I didn't think of those as horror. I thought of them as science fiction or adventure.
They're actually, I'd say the best way to put it is speculative.
Yeah, speculative.
Yeah. So.
What if?
The what if stories,
Oh, that's awesome. So, this is, I think we're way over an hour, aren't we?
I guess we're out.
We can do it. Oh, let me say that I want the whole room to do this, and you've all given me permission to use this.
Left foot out.
No. I have a sign-off. I have a sign-off on Professor Drake's Action Film Autopsy, and my sign-off is, use your blinkers, jackass. Because I've been needing that more and more.
God,
every episode ends with me saying, and remember, and then we say it. So I'm going to have, I would like all of you to say it at this after I count off to three. Is everybody ready?
Yeah.
Okay. 1, 2, 3.
Use your blinkers, jackass.
And get off the phone.
Okay, break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more Film Fun, Frenzy, and Friends. Until then, check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.
Sonic Victory.